From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, crop formations and flying humanoids from Mexico. That's right, Ed and Chris Sherwood, our guest. You might want to get up to the coasttocoastam.com website before they come on next hour. They sent us a series of images. You might want to take a look at some of those. Some of the news of the day, then we'll get into our special interview this hour. Well, Richard Branson, who's the chairman of the Virgin Group, says that his company is looking into machines and new technologies to put on his aircrafts to kill germs in anticipation of a bird flu pandemic. I mean, this thing is running all over the place now. He said his company has purchased 10,000 doses of the drug Tamiflu for his staff in response to questions about companies hoarding this vaccine. He says, we've bought them for our staff. They're on the front line. Branson has also said that despite Virgin's best efforts to protect all passengers, if the flu starts spreading person to person, it will almost certainly affect the airline industry. The Bush administration sent officials over to Congress to explain details of its $7.1 billion avian influenza pandemic plan, but has already come under attack from critics who said that it offered too little too late. The plan, which President Bush announced on Tuesday, focuses on building stockpiles of drugs and encouraging companies to develop vaccines, and asks states to step up with substantial contributions of their own. It also includes $251 million for affected nations in Asia to help monitor this disease and build new laboratories, but the initial outlay is modest. What I would say, according to a special assistant to the President for Biological Defense Policy, is that the $251 million sounds like a small amount in the context of a budget that totals $7.1 billion, but this is merely a crash program that would at least make a start at preparing the United States for a possible outbreak of the avian flu in people. Critics say the U.S. government was too slow to act. It should have happened 5 years ago, according to the dean of the School of Public Health at Columbia University in New York. What's so amazing about this story, though, is how worldwide everyone in government seems to be panicking about this, and that I cannot understand. Well, you know, as we followed that horrible earthquake that hit Pakistan on October 8th, it started with a few thousand that they said had died, and then that grew to 15,000. Well, now, listen to the total, they say, and that's going to go even higher. Pakistan says more than 73,000 people died in that quake that devastated its north and Kashmir. The officials have no idea why it jumped so high. It was at 57,000 yesterday, and they say that the new figures, whenever they're released again, will go even higher. Estimates of at least 80,000 people dead. In Sydney, Australia, a lightning strike killed 68 dairy cows waiting to be milked on an Australian farm. The cows were standing together in a paddock when an electrical storm hit there. These cows were killed instantly. Another 69 survived. Health authorities in northern Brazil are trying to cope with a wave of attacks on humans by vampire bats infected with a deadly rabies virus. Rabies caused by bat bites has killed 23 people already in the last 2 months. It's not the first wave of attacks by vampire bats in the Amazon, but Brazilian authorities say this latest outbreak is unusually serious. They blame it for chopping down all the trees in the Amazon. A suicide bomber detonated a minibus in an outdoor market in Baghdad, packed with shoppers ahead of a Muslim festival, killing about 20 people, wounding more than 60. In a small town right next to Baghdad, 6 U.S. troops killed, 2 in a helicopter crash west of the capital. At least now, according to the Associated Press, 2,034 U.S. military service members have died since the Iraq conflict began in March of 2003. With details emerging about the progress of a probe in the pre-Iraq war intelligence, Republicans still stewing by what they call a Democratic stunt to force a rare closed Senate session. Democrats claim that the Republican leadership had been dragging its feet on completing the so-called phase two of the Senate Intelligence Committee investigation into the pre-war intelligence, which the panel began working on in February of 2004. What's interesting, though, if you look at the old tapes before we went into Iraq, Democrats and Republicans alike were talking about Saddam Hussein and pointing their fingers at him and trying to make a case for war. Now it seems everybody is moving into their own camp. So a good thing for audio and videotape. We can always pull that out to show them what they said. In Detroit, a packed church with 4,000 mourners celebrated the life of Rosa Parks in a very impassioned, song-filled funeral with a crowd of notables giving thanks for the humble woman whose dignity and defiance helped transform a nation. The funeral, which stretched well past its three-hour scheduled time, followed a week of remembrances during which her coffin was brought from Detroit, where she died October 24th, to Montgomery, Alabama, where she sparked the civil rights movement 50 years ago by refusing to give up her bus seat to a white man. And she was a remarkable woman. I met her in my early days as a reporter in Detroit, and just was extremely pleasant to everybody. In Newark, New Jersey, a woman who admitted hiding the body of a 7-year-old relative in a basement storage bin has been sentenced to 25 years in prison. Her son, who killed the child in a wrestling move, was sentenced to 3 years. My, oh my. In Denver, residents of that mile-high city have voted to allow adults to possess up to an ounce of marijuana, except state possession laws, they say, will be applied instead. So I don't think it means much. Researchers from NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland believe they have captured traces of radiation from long-extinguished stars that were born during the universe's infancy. The research represents the first tangible but not conclusive evidence of these earliest stars, which are thought to have produced the raw materials which future stars, including our sun, were created. The Big Bang, the explosion believed to have created the universe, is thought to have occurred 13.7 billion years ago. About 100 million years later, hydrogen atoms began to merge and ignite, creating brightly burning stars. And Chinese scientists say they have gathered evidence that shows a giant object in the center of our galaxy is a supermassive black hole. Researchers at an observatory captured radio waves emitted just beyond the edge of the mysterious object known as Sagittarius A, with a system of 10 radio telescopes spread across the United States. In a hole in the science journal Nature, they say that it provides strong evidence that Sagittarius A is a supermassive black hole. The celestial objects that pull in everything around them, including light, are among the most mysterious objects in the universe. As a matter of fact, in a moment, Seth Shostak, astronomer, our guest, we're going to talk with him about this and about SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Seth Shostak is the senior astronomer for SETI. Now, that search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and he's responsible for much of the outreach activities of that institute, editing the newsletter, overseeing the website, giving talks, writing magazine articles about SETI. He also teaches a half a dozen informal education classes on astronomy and other topics in the Bay Area. He's our guest this hour on Coast to Coast. Seth, you've been away too long. How are you?
Well, I'm okay, George, and it's good to talk with you again.
Likewise. Hey, let's talk about the Van Allen Telescope Array first, and then we'll get into some of these magnificent finds that astronomers seem to be creating, finding, stumbling into across this universe. How's that coming, the Van Allen Telescope, Paul Allen Telescope Array?
Right. Van Allen has the belt, but this is this is a telescope, and indeed it's named after Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft, who's given a lot of the money to get the research and development for this thing underway. Well, in fact, if you were to drive up into the Cascade Mountains of Northern California tomorrow and take a look, what you'd find is about three dozen of these antennas planted in the lava fields there. Three dozen antennas each about 20 feet across. So they're pretty big. They would monopolize your backyard. But they're small by traditional radio astronomy standards. But the idea is to have lots more of them, ultimately 350.
Now, when you have this accumulation of this kind of radio telescope power, what will it do that you can't do now?
Well, that's the beauty of this thing. You see, there's been sort of a shift, George, in the way you build radio telescopes, because in the past, the problem was that the electronics, the receivers that you put up there at the focus, were very expensive, very specialized. They had to be, very sensitive, but also very low noise, so that you actually heard the cosmos and not just your receiver. And it's not such a problem, of course, for example, this radio show, because, the transmitters are pretty powerful.
Sure.
And they're usually, within 50 miles of wherever you're listening. But when you're listening to something that's many light years away, the signals are going to be weak. So you want these low noise receivers. Well, those things were expensive. They usually cost, maybe millions of dollars, put it that way. And so you couldn't build lots of antennas because you couldn't outfit them with the electronics, even though little antennas are a heck of a lot cheaper than big antennas. You know that big antenna down in Puerto Rico?
Arecibo.
Arecibo. We've done a couple of shows, I think, from down there.
Yep.
And many listeners will know that antenna from, the movies. But if you wanted to build that sort of thing again, if you wanted to build a second Arecibo, I don't know what it costs, but it'd be about $100 million.
Oh my!
That's a lot of money. So these days, because of the fact that electronics has gotten really inexpensive, now you can buy the electronics for a telescope for maybe a few thousand dollars instead of a few million. The whole paradigm has shifted, as they like to say here in the Silicon Valley, and that means now we're going to build radio telescopes out of lots and lots of little ones instead of one giant one. So that's the first advantage, is just cheaper. But the second advantage is the fact that lots of little ones do things for you that one big one never can to begin with. That thing down at Arecibo typically looks at one spot on the sky at a time. And that really sort of slows you down if you're looking for ET. Yeah.
So this array gives you an opportunity to really scan the heavens.
Everything will be sped up. And, in fact, once you have 350 of them in place, the gain in speed over the searches in the past is, a few hundred times. And then as you add more compute power, as compute power continues to get less expensive, and, of course, it does, then that speed increment will go up and up and up. And the bottom line is pretty simple. Up until now, we've looked carefully at fewer than 1,000 star systems in our galaxy, 1,000 star systems.
That's it?
That's it. I mean, that's been looked at carefully.
Yeah.
But the Allen Telescope Array in the next 15, 20 years will be able to look at maybe a million.
Oh, my.
So,
sound, one voice. That's all we need.
Well, of course, the SETI community is always optimistic. Success might be around the corner, and it might be next week. But if you really look at the numbers, it sounds pretty hopeful that in the next 15, 20 years, we may trip across a signal simply because we will have looked at so much cosmic real estate.
All right, Seth, when will the switch be flipped and this thing will be working and operational?
Yeah, well, I get that question a lot. And unfortunately, most of the answer depends on how quickly we can raise the money to build it, as it turns out.
Well, what do you mean? He's giving you 15 mil, right?
Yeah, well, that's right. And that's not a small amount of money. But it turns out that if you want to put in the remaining, 300 and some antennas, you need millions more.
Oh, okay.
So, we're trying to raise that money, and I think we will. But we build them as quickly as we can. We can actually put them together at the rate of about one a day. I've watched them put them together, and it's kind of interesting. And they do it in one day. One day they can put one together. So,
what's your best guess, though?
Well,
in this,
my best guess is within 3 or 4 years the whole thing will be put together. But that's my guess.
Well, how come the government doesn't step in? Look at the money they're spending on other projects.
Yes.
$7.1 billion for this pandemic that I believe will never occur. Why can't they fund this?
Well, maybe they can. I mean, we're certainly trying to find some interest in the government for doing this, because, as you point out, it's very inexpensive compared to almost any government project. But, George, maybe the good news is that even though we'll only have about 40 of these antennas in place this coming spring, we are going to turn it on.
Oh, you are?
We're going to
Okay.
throw that big switch and start using it to do science, even with that limited number of
Okay,
antennas.
even with the 40, how would that then compare with Arecibo?
Well, that's smaller than Arecibo by at least a factor of 10. Okay, in
All
fact,
right.
more than that. It's less sensitive. But on the other hand, we get to use it 24/7 for SETI. And so we thought, well, what's the best experiment to do when you've got not too much sensitivity, but you got lots of telescope time? And so the scheme is to look near the center of our galaxy. Just pick out 20 square degrees of the sky. What is that? That's like 80 full moons, something like that. Okay. And but right near the center of the galaxy, looking where all those stars are clotted up. And in that way, we will, you know, we'll be checking out many tens of millions of star systems. It's just that they'll be very far away, so we can't look at them in great detail the way we will be able to do later.
This story today of astronomers finding traces of radiation from long extinguished stars that they believe were born during the universe's infancy, 100 million years later after the Big Bang. We're getting pretty close now, aren't we?
Well, that's a very interesting result. Yeah, what we're getting close about, of course, is looking almost all the way back to the Big Bang. What you want to know is what happened in those very early days. Mm-hmm. You know, physics can sort of tell you what happens in the first, you know, couple of minutes. And then, you know, the universe is bright and, you know, there's light everywhere. You can't see a thing because it's so darn hot. And we know from the physics that after a couple of 100,000 years, the universe is big enough, it cools down and it gets dark. And then it's dark until stars are made. And one of the big questions in astronomy in recent years has been, well, those dark ages between, you know, the point where the universe got cool enough to be transparent and dark and the time when the first stars lit up, how long was that? And what were those first stars like? They probably weren't very much like the sun because, you know, the universe was a lot smaller back then. It hadn't expanded very far. The density of stuff was millions of times what it is now. So those first stars would have been heavy duty. I mean, they would have been hundreds of times bigger than the sun. So they would have been mammoth things. And it would be very interesting to know when it happened and, you know, what happened. What kind of stars were they? Because those were the stars that belched out all the stuff that became, you know, the stuff of other stars and ultimately planets and life. So those first stars were important.
I had a professor on last week, Seth, and he said something pretty interesting. And I always knew this, but it just didn't really sink in. And he said all the material from the beginning of the universe, everything is in all of us. And that's pretty astounding when you think about it.
Well, it's true. I mean, the atoms that make up you and me, of course, are you know, 13.7 billion years old. I mean, nothing new there. I mean, you can also work out, you know, how many air molecules you breathe in with every breath were once breathed in by Julius Caesar, and that's a pretty big number, too.
That's true.
But the really interesting thing here, and this point is made all the time in the astronomy courses, is that the Big Bang only made hydrogen and helium. That's it. Didn't make things like carbon and nitrogen and oxygen and phosphorus, which are, you know, a big constituent of what you're made of. It didn't make those things. Those had to be made in stars, those elements. And some of those big early stars made some of that stuff, and then they die and they blow up, and they throw all this stuff out into space, and then that condenses and makes other stars, and then they die and blow up. And eventually, they made the sun and the planets. And so your body is largely made out of stuff that was once cooked up right in the deep centers of big stars. And, you know, that's so far from our everyday experience, it's kind of hard to picture that, but it's true.
Hey, they found two more moons for Pluto. Maybe, huh?
Yeah, looks good. Yeah, now Pluto has three. You know, the outer solar system has more moons than a college frat party, I would say. I mean, that's right. Three moons and Pluto, and that's a pretty small system. And, you know, it presents a lot of puzzles. Of course, the real reason they're looking at Pluto so carefully is that, in principle, what's going to happen in just a couple of months, in January, is that NASA's going to send off this new mission, right, to go out to Pluto, the New Horizons mission, it's called. It'll go out to Pluto. It'll take about 10 years to get there. It's a long way to Pluto. And then after that, it'll keep on going and go out to the Kuiper Belt, you know, where things like the 10th planet are. So, you know, that's pretty exciting stuff. And as I say, the thing about Pluto and its new moons is understanding how they were made.
Well, stay with us because we're going to take some phone calls with you, Seth. You ready?
Ready.
Dr. Seth Shostak, our guest. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Been to any malls lately? Christmas decorations up all over the place. Normally, they used to wait until Thanksgiving at least came, but no, they're starting early again. Well, I guess we will too. This is going to be available for about a month and a half, and then that is it. The After Dark double CD, ghost stories, bumper music, and some unforgettable calls to the program. There's a website that you can order right off of. That's afterdarkcd.com. Or this toll-free number, 1-800-598-2331. 1-800-598-2331. This would make a great Christmas holiday gift, so jump on board while you can. It's got about 6-7 weeks, and that'll be it. Back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest, Dr. Seth Shostak, and your phone calls as well. I see you, Seth, everywhere. You're on Discovery. You just, no matter where I turn, there you are, always getting quoted on something.
Well, George, I apologize. That's all I can say to that. It entertains my mom.
Did I not see you on Larry King's UFO special?
You did, actually, yes.
What's your take on all that?
Well, you know how I feel about the UFO story, but it was an interesting show. There were, I think, a total of 5 guests, including Bud Hopkins.
And right.
There were 3 who thought that the UFOs might, at least some of them, might be alien craft. And there was me as the skeptic. And then there was this psychologist, Susan Clancy from Harvard, who has done some studies on sleep paralysis, which she thinks that explains the abduction story. So that's one aspect of the whole phenomenon. And it was interesting. I was in the studio next to Mr. King, and that, of course, was very nice because you could talk to him during the commercial breaks.
To the phones we go, east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Good morning, George.
Good morning to you, sir. Go ahead.
I have a question. This is Jeff from Pomeroy, Ohio.
All right.
Along the Ohio River. And I was originally born in Delaware County, which is the home of Perkins Observatory. And I believe it was in the mid-70s where they had an array set up to where they recorded the WOW signal.
Yes. That was at Ohio State, Jeff.
Yes. And I wanted to know if a signal any stronger than that has been recorded, or could you fill in some more information about that?
Well, yeah, the WOW signal, you know, it has more notoriety than...
anything, really?
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm going to name a few criminals. I mean, it's very famous, and I think that the principal reason that it's famous is because it has a really catchy name, and that's due to a fellow by the name of Jerry Ehrman. I'll get it right, E-H, I think, are the first 2 letters of his name, and he was a scientist working there at the Ohio State Observatory. And they had this telescope 24 hours a day looking for signals. It just sat there and, you know, let the Earth rotate. So the sky's moving across the beam of the telescope, and they would just record the signals coming out over many channels with, in those days, just a computer line printer. You know, just came out on paper. And this guy, Jerry Ehrman, would go in every morning and, you know, he would look at what it had printed out the day before.
And it would always look the same.
It would always look the same. It's noise, you know, that kind of stuff. But one day he saw a signal that was so strong, he wrote WOW on the margins of the paper, right? So it became known as the WOW signal. Now, the deal is that that telescope actually had kind of 2 receivers in one there. And so when it would observe one section of the sky, about 1 minute and 10 seconds later, it would observe it a second time. And the second observation did not show that signal. Beyond that, A fellow by the name of Bob Gray in the Midwest has looked for the WOW signal using other telescopes since then, with more sensitivity, with more coverage of the radio dial. He's done it all around the world, and he's never seen the WOW signal. So it was only seen once. Jeff, I'm afraid you can't claim it's ET.
Will you be able to aim the Allen Telescope Array in that direction when that gets up and running?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, you could do. You could do. Yes.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Pete from Michigan.
Hi, Pete.
Hi. I think the last time I was on, Seth was on. we were talking about radio frequencies to listen to. But this time I'd like to run something by him as far as where to look in a galaxy.
Sure.
If you take a look at NGC 1300,
Spiral galaxy.
Yeah, you've noticed what something I've been calling is the ring of life, that outer ring of older stars that are in a more stable environment where civilizations could flourish over, you know, the millennia, versus the central part where there's probably too much turbulence for life to continue.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point, Pete. Now, NGC 1300, for those folks who don't have pictures of it over the mantle, is one of the most beautiful galaxies in the sky. Unfortunately, it's in the southern hemisphere, as I recall, so it's kind of hard to see from the north. But it's what's called a barred spiral, so it has a big bar. But actually, the Milky Way is probably a barred spiral, so, you know, there are lots of barred spirals. But I think what you're referring to, Pete, is this idea that if there are lots of aliens out there, they're not in the central regions of the galaxy. They're kind of in the suburbs. They're in this big ring where things are a little more placid, and, you know, if you cook up a life on a planet, it doesn't get blown away by supernovae going off in the neighborhood and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a very popular idea in some, should I say, circles? I don't know. don't mean to make a pun. But it's, you know, I have to say that I'm not entirely convinced that the situation is as dire as that, that those central regions are really ruled out. I've never seen it that way, but look, even if you buy into this, even if you say, look, only the suburbs are going to count, you've thrown away maybe a half or two-thirds of the galaxy, but you still have, you know, 100 billion stars left over, so there's no paucity of real estate, even if you do that.
Oh, I'm thoroughly convinced there are so many civilizations out there, we just can't count them.
And yeah. I can't wait to find them.
Will we aim at the Sirius star system as well? You know, a lot of people have thought that perhaps extraterrestrials have originated from that area, Seth.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, I occasionally get emails from people who are suggesting their favorite star system. But, you know, the usual tactic is that you just look at everything that's really close by. I mean, Sirius doesn't sound like a, well, very serious candidate because, you know, it's a multiple star system, the three stars there, and that would make it tough on planets, but maybe not. These days, multiple stars are not being ruled out so quickly as homes for planets, at least. Sirius is kind of a hot star, and that doesn't sound so good either. But, you know, again, I don't think you'd rule it out. The facts are Sirius is not very far away from us. So it will be looked at. It has been looked at, actually, but, you know, we'll look at it again. What you typically do is you look at the nearest couple of hundred stars in any case, and then when you're looking farther away, you begin to get selective and say, well, I'm not going to look at these giant stars or things like that that you know are not going to have ET because they don't live long enough to cook up anything like ET. So, you know, you're pretty indiscriminate when you're nearby, and you get more discriminating as you move out.
How accurate, Seth, can you determine the age of a star or system out there?
Well, it's pretty hard. What you do know is that, you know, you can sort of predict the lifetimes of stars. And it just depends on their size. It's sort of like predicting the lifetimes of animals in a way. I mean, you know that turtles will live long, and you know that insects will live for short periods, I mean, you know, just on the basis of what they are. And the same with stars. You know the very big ones go through their fuel very quickly. So you know how long they're going to live. But if you say, no, wait a minute. What I really want to know is this star over here, has it been around for a few billion years so that it's had time to cook up maybe some intelligence?
Mm-hmm, right.
And that's harder to do. Stars do change with time. And you know, if you study it carefully, you can get some idea of about how old it is. Not really accurately, but maybe within a billion or 2 billion years. And that might be good enough. The trouble is it's a slow process. So we don't have that information for a whole lot of stars.
If you were, let's say, at the Sirius star system looking at our solar system, would you have to point your radio telescopes directly at Earth to possibly pick up any sounds, or just that general area?
Yeah, just the general area is good enough. I mean, if you were to have something like, well, we were talking about the Arecibo telescope.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had that on a planet around Sirius and you aimed it at the Earth, you wouldn't really have to aim at the Earth. You just aim it at the sun. And it turns out that the beam of that telescope, in other words, the area to which it's sensitive, would encompass not just, you know, the sun and Mercury and Venus and Earth, but also Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. It would encompass probably, you know, most of the solar system, if not all of it. I'd have to work out the numbers. But you don't have to aim it very accurately, it turns out.
West of the Rockies, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi.
Hi, Seth?
Yes.
This is Becca, your niece.
Uh-oh.
Well, I was reading up today about the fact that there's, like, a black hole in the middle of our galaxy. And I wanted to ask you if there's any estimate on how long it would be before objects in our solar system were sucked in, or whether the sun would enlarge and destroy everything before that happens.
All right. Well, since it's my niece, I've got to answer this one, George.
Yes, you
and,
may.
And I promise you, I didn't tell any of my relatives that I'd be on the show tonight, so...
Actually, my friend called me and told me that you were on, and I've never heard you on the show before, so...
There you go.
Kind of cool.
Not to worry, Becca. the sun and the Earth and all the planets around here are so far from even the nearest black holes, let alone that big guy down in the center of the galaxy that's been in the papers today. They're so far away from that thing... You know, those big black holes, yes, they suck, but they're not going to suck. They're not going to suck us in. Not going to happen. It's like having the one in the center of the galaxy has a mass of about 4 million suns, right? So, but that means it has the gravity of 4 million suns too. And there, you know, there are hundreds of billions of stars around, and they're not sucking us into them either. So you don't have to worry about that. It's only if you got really close to one of these black holes that things get uncomfortable.
Oh, is that what the event horizon is?
Well, the event horizon is a region that's very close to the black holes, and that's kind of the point of no return. If you get any closer to a black hole than that, you're a goner.
Okay, thanks, Becca.
Thanks, Seth.
Bye.
Sounds like the astronomy runs in the family, huh?
Well, she's always been interested, yes. She's a college student now.
Is she really? Yes. Good for her. First-time caller line. Welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Yes, I have a quick question.
Sure.
Why don't you use the antenna array that's in New Mexico?
Yeah, the very large array. You see that in the movies a lot, too. In fact, Jodie Foster used it in Contact.
That's where it was. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been in other films, too, I think. I mean,
why don't you use it?
Well, I mean, I have used it, George, but not for SETI, because it turns out it's not really quite the right telescope for SETI. Actually,
okay.
You know, it's 27 antennas. But if you add up all that collecting area, it's about the same as what the Allen Telescope Array will have. And the real problem with the Very Large Array is that the receivers are not really the right ones for SETI. And by the way, another point is that the Very Large Array is so useful for astronomy that it's being used all the time for astronomy, so you wouldn't get a whole lot of observing time there.
What kind of receivers do you need?
Well, when I say receivers, you know, what there are receivers and they're receivers. When you think of a receiver on an antenna like this, you're thinking of that box that's up at the focus, you know, on top of that tripod that's usually sitting on the dish.
Sure.
But that's really just an amplifier that amplifies the signal. That's what that does. But then it sends that amplified signal down cables, usually into some, you know, kind of undistinguished brick building nearby where you have what you might call the digital receivers. These are the things that split up the radio dial into the tens and hundreds of millions of channels that you want to split them up to into in order to pick up a SETI signal. And the VLA isn't designed to split up, you know, cosmic static into millions of channels. That's not something you do in astronomy.
And if I recall, you do not believe we've been visited by extraterrestrials on this planet, but you definitely believe in intelligent life out there somewhere.
Yeah, kind of interesting. Some people think there's something inconsistent about that, but that's true. You've accurately described my position.
Wildcard Line, welcome to Coast. Hello there.
Hey, this is Kevin in Tulsa.
Hi, Kevin. Go ahead.
I'm not quite sure how to word this question, but I'll give it a shot. Supposing we can look back to the very beginning of the universe, and it is 13.5 billion light years away from us, how can we see a universe that is small, like it was at the beginning, but imposed on a sphere that's, to our perspective, 26 billion light years across?
Yeah.
It's like a weird optical illusion.
Yeah, yeah. You think it might be just a little point of light somewhere or something like that.
Right.
Yeah.
But we see it everywhere.
Yeah, well, you do see it everywhere. That's the thing. I mean, you know, this is all, you got to, you know, you're going to have to stay up till 3 o'clock tonight. Well, after you're finished listening to George, you're going to have to stay up and think about this because it's kind of non-intuitive. But remember, we were always inside the universe. And 13 billion years ago, the universe was a lot smaller, but we were inside it too. So whatever was going on, all this glow was always all around us. See, it isn't that, you know, there was this little point of light over there.
Right.
Right. And now we're 13 and a half billion years, light years away from
it. If you were able to look at it, you'd be able to see it all over the place.
That's right. And we are able to look at it, and we do see it all over the place. It's this background glow. It's, you know, because the universe has expanded, the glow has all been shifted down the dial.
Are you a believer, Seth, in parallel universes like so many other physicists? And you're an astronomer, of course, but so many others are beginning to think, well, maybe there could be more than just this one.
Yeah, well, it is a fashionable idea. And guys like Michio Kaku, who I think you have on the show fairly regularly, he's got a book with that title, Parallel Universes, in fact. You know what's fashionable about it, or why it's fashionable, I should say, is that, of course, it explains why our universe is so good. Because if you say, look, there's zillions of other universes, and most of them are pretty crummy, where they don't have stars, they don't have planets, and so forth. But, you know, a few of them, by chance, will be good enough to cook up life, then there's no miracle about this universe, because, you know, this universe is pretty good for life.
Yeah, we do have a good one. I was going to say we lucked out, then I stopped myself. Seth, because we didn't luck out. I think it was designed this way.
Well, that's one possibility. The other possibility, which physicists like, because maybe you can write more papers about it, is to say, look, if you have zillions of universes, each slightly different, some of them are going to be good for life. And of course, we're going to be asking questions about universes in a universe that's good for life, because otherwise we won't be around to ask the questions. So it solves that problem. The difficulty with parallel universes, of course, is how can you possibly prove that they exist? And, you know.
At least not right now.
Not right now.
Hey, real quickly, I understand that you're coming up with some ideas on how to design listening experiments.
Well, yeah, I have some ideas about, you know, just trying to think of, from the aliens' point of view, what kind of signals would they broadcast into space? And just very quickly, I think maybe they would use a two-tiered strategy. They'd have a very bright, flashing radio signal or light signal to get our attention, and then, you know, sort of a low-level signal that has all the information. Because if you found a bright flashing thing, you would spend a lot of money and a lot of time looking for that low-level signal. So this sort of two-tiered strategy might make sense from the aliens' point of view, and maybe we should sort of tune our SETI experiments to at least consider looking for those bright flashing signals coming our way.
Almost like turning on a big flashlight every once in a while.
Sort of like a lighthouse, really, in a way.
I wonder, Seth, if letting everyone know where we are is the smart thing to do.
Yeah, that's a very controversial topic, and it has been the subject of, I would say, about 500 emails recently amongst the SETI community. And there are some people who think that it's not a good idea. There are others who think that it doesn't really matter. And besides, if you do think it's a bad idea, you know, we've already been broadcasting into space.
It may be a little too late.
It may be a little too late.
Well, you know what? Let's just hope they don't get the Twilight Zone episode To Serve Man.
Yeah.
They might get the wrong idea.
Well, yes.
Okay. Yes. Hey, Seth, thanks a lot. I appreciate you being on the program.
Always a pleasure, George.
That's astronomer Seth Shostak. Wonderful guy. His website, SETI, SETI.org. When we come right back, it's Ed and Chris Sherwood, Crop Formations. Get up to the coasttocoastam.com website. Take a look at the images they have sent us. We're going to be talking about them tonight, as well as flying humanoids in Mexico.